We're treating this just as a table and not an altar or anything. Never miss an opportunity to make use of a practical visual aid. To be or not to be? That is the question. Well, I don't know whether it's the question. It's certainly a question. How about some more Shakespeare? What's in a name? Juliet muses about Romeo. And she goes on. I needn't bother with this slide. A rose by any other name would smell as sweet. Of course, it doesn't actually matter what you refer to as a rose. What you call it, of course, how it looks and how it smells is not defined by its name. Of course, the problem for Romeo and Juliet is they belong to different families with different names, so they aren't free to marry. So maybe names do matter. The Bible certainly seems to think so as well, although it recognises, as with a lot of us, that parents usually give children names because they like the sound of the name, not anything to do necessarily with the inherent meaning behind that name. They may hope or aspire that the child will grow up and aspire to the meaning that they've given, but it's probably a bit of a lottery if we're honest. Now, in the first couple of weeks of our series, going through this lectionary series on the Old Testament, we've already encountered four occasions where names have either been given or have changed, and let's run through them quickly just to remind you. So in Genesis chapter 17, God promises that Abraham will become the father of a nation in his old age, and he gives him the name Abraham from Abram. He also instructs Abraham to rename his wife from Sarai to Sarah, and he tells him what the name of the promised son will be, which is Isaac, and Simon spoke about that, I think it was 3 weeks ago on Genesis 18 when we heard about that. And then, not last week, but the week before, we had the story of Jacob in Genesis chapter 32. And Jacob, you remember, wrestled with God, received an injury, demanded a blessing, which he got, but also received a new name from God. And God said to him, as is in verse 28, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome." And I'd like you to know, actually in that story, if you remember, before we go on, Jacob pressed his mysterious opponent, that we know actually was God, to give him his name, and God on that occasion refused. And of course there are other people in the Bible as well you can probably think of who were named or renamed, and usually as a result of that, as a result of birth, or maybe rebirth we might say, we might also say conversion, and they often received after that a blessing and a commission. And I'm going to sum that up as birth, blessing, and commission, or BBC. So if you remember nothing else from my sermon today, you will at least remember those three sermon points every time you hear the name or initials BBC, and you'll probably be cursing me for the rest of the week. But at least we could have had a whole sermon on that, perhaps. But let's return to Exodus. So that's four people who have been named, Isaac, or renamed, Abraham, Sarah, and Jacob. And the last three actually had a direct encounter with God. And that's the same true for Moses in our passage this morning. And he also receives a commission from God. But we're looking at names, specifically God's name. And I do feel this is rather hallowed ground. But that's the passage, so we'll have to deal with that and touch on that. So let's set the scene first. At the start of chapter 1, as we had in our reading, Jacob's family have emigrated to Egypt. Several hundred years have passed. They've grown in number. And the new pharaoh doesn't know anything about their history. They're basically just the immigrant sheep farmers that live in the north of the country. And the Egyptians fear their numbers and their health and their vitality, and so they subjugate them and make them forced labor for all their building projects. Moses is born. He's rescued from his Moses basket by an Egyptian princess. He grows up an Egyptian prince. But then one day, and we didn't read this, he sees an Egyptian abusing one of the Israelites, and he kills the Egyptian. And this is seen, Pharaoh gets to hear about it, and Moses has to flee for his life. And he flees to Midian, where he marries, and he becomes a sheep farmer, basically, for his father-in-law for 40 years in the desert. And one day, he sees this burning bush in the desert, burning but not consumed by the fire. And he's curious enough to go over and have a look at it. So we could say he's approached God in that sense. So God knows that he's got his attention, and God tells him to do a simple thing, to take his shoes off because he's on holy ground. which Moses does, and that shows that Moses is ready to listen to God. He's receptive and open to him. And God says to him, and we're going to use this phrase quite a bit, I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And then God tells Moses that he's seen the misery and the suffering of his people in Egypt, and he's going to send Moses to go and rescue them. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. And not unreasonably, Moses says, well, who am I to do that, to go and speak to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Not only did Moses not think he was up to the task, and I think we've all come to realize recently that trying to extricate one nation from a larger political entity is a difficult task, you also have to remember the personal history here. He's still got an open murder charge against him. He probably wasn't very keen to go back to Pharaoh and deliver what's going to be an unpopular message with that crime still hanging over his head. But God assures Moses that he's going to be with him. He gives him the promise of a sign that they'll worship on mountains later on with the Israelites. And that's important for Moses' later on story. Mountains are quite important for Moses throughout the rest of Exodus and even on into the New Testament, because you remember that Moses appears alongside Jesus at the Transfiguration. But that's all for Moses' future. So Moses asks God this very odd question. He doesn't ask who's sending him, because he knows it's the God of his fathers. He knows who God is. But he says, what name shall I give to the Israelites when you send me on this quest or this commission? Now, this makes sense when you realize that Moses' first response to God is, I'm not up to this task. And when God says, I'm going to send you anyway and I'll support you, Moses' response is, who are you, basically? Give me some sort of validation or qualifications. So I'm not up to it. I know I'm not up to it. But who are you that you should be up to it and to support me in doing that? Because up to this point, God has only really been known by titles throughout the rest of the preceding chapters of Genesis, particularly the God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, etc. And God hasn't revealed his name up until this point. He chose not to reveal his name to Jacob, even when he was asked. And what an unusual name it is. And I guess maybe many of us have some verb aspect to the meaning of our names, but this is the verb to be. We'll come on to that. So you're probably aware that God's personal name, Yahweh, actually we were singing it earlier, weren't we, as rendered in Hebrew, is also written in our English Bibles with Lord with small capital letters. So that's when God's personal name occurs in an English Bible, and I guess it's probably the same for other translations as well. But the key point is that this name occurs in the Old Testament before it's been given in Exodus chapter 3. And for those of you who are paying attention, it actually cropped up in the reading in verses 2 and 4 as well, before God says, reveals his name in verse 15. So is this a slip of the pen? Well, I'd suggest not. This is done for emphasis at this particular point to mark this start of this key passage in Moses' history and also the history of the Israelites. The first use actually comes in Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, the kind of summary account of creation where God, or the account says, this is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created, when the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. And Lord or Yahweh continues to be used throughout the rest of Genesis as appropriate to the occasion multiple times. And this actually is one of the reasons why the Jews attributed the writing of Genesis to Moses, because obviously it couldn't theoretically have been written before that, probably based on oral tradition. So let's put that issue aside. The other thing you need to bear in mind is the ancient world attributed power to those who knew the personal names of deities, spirits, angels, demons, etc. The idea being that if you knew a being's personal name, it gave you some power over it, in a magical or a superstitious sense. So you almost need to think a bit like sort of Aladdin and the genie of the lamp, that type of thing. You could conjure the spirit up and get it to do your bidding. Now, clearly, the all-powerful God of the universe is not showing any weakness by revealing his personal name. In fact, on the contrary, what he's really doing is he's kind of reaching down to humanity and choosing to reveal something of his nature and his character to strengthen the relationship between an all-powerful, perfect creator God that we were singing about with a frail, broken, weak humanity in the form of Moses and his people, Israel. Now, God gives his personal name as I am who I am. Or if you look at the footnotes in the NIV Bibles we've got, it can also be translated, I will be who I will be. And it's probably not beyond the bounds of reason to translate that as I have been who I have been, although perhaps that's less usual. So it's an unusual name in that sense, particularly perhaps unusual in English, because I think the verb to be is quite a common verb, probably is in other languages. Unhelpfully in English, this is just an aside, it's also a very irregular verb, that doesn't really matter. But it's also not typical in that it's not an action word, which is what most verbs are. Verbs can also describe status, so it's fairly unusual from that point of view. But let's come back to Hamlet for a moment, to be or not to be. For Hamlet, there may be doubt about existence, about the desirability of existence, about the nature of existence. But for God, there cannot be any not be. God cannot unwill himself not to be. And although I've said the verb to be is describes a state of being, for God, this state of being is actually quite an active state of being. There's a real declaration or intent, if you think about it, in saying, I am who I am. I will be who I will be. This is not a passive being. It's in God's nature to act and to be active and to reveal. And he reveals something about his nature to Moses by revealing his name in that way. Now, before moving on to some practical application, which perhaps was a bit of a challenge with this passage, if you think about it, I'd also like to make a link with Jesus, actually very appropriately as we were just singing in the last song. Because a lot of people have said that Jesus makes no claim to be God, or they question whether he really meant it to be understood that way. But one of the clearest claims that Jesus makes to being God is actually involves the use of God's personal name. And it occurs in John chapter 8 of the Gospel, which is mainly a very long theological discussion between Jesus and the Pharisees about the validity of Jesus' ministry. Which, if you read it in an English translation, seems fairly straightforward. But anyway, the dispute comes to a head with these words, with the issue that Jesus claims to have pre-existed Abraham, also in our passage. Which, of course, if he was part of the Godhead, he would have done. He would be. And Jesus concludes his argument with the Pharisees by saying, before Abraham was, I am. Now, the Pharisees knew exactly what Jesus was claiming by that. And that's why it then goes on to say they picked up stones to stone him, because that was the punishment for blasphemy. And you can't get much more blasphemous than claiming that you are God. And Jesus managed to slip away. So let's not be fooled. Don't let anybody tell you that Jesus never claimed to be God, that he didn't intend his claim to be understood that way, or that his first century audience didn't know exactly what he was claiming when he applied God's personal name to himself. Okay, so what practical value does all this have for us? What's the application of knowing that God's name, that he's the God of the past, the present, and the future? Well, I'm going to suggest firstly that an all-knowing, all-seeing God who still desires to have a relationship with everyone who will come to him, everyone who's prepared to acknowledge their sins and failings, make him Lord of their lives, is a God who truly forgives and who can be relied upon to forgive, not just because he said so, but because it's in his nature to do so. And I'm saying this because I know many people actually struggle, not so much with God forgiving them, perhaps, but forgiving themselves for past failures or mistakes. But if those things have been brought to God and asked for forgiveness, then God forgives them. As far as he's concerned, the slate is wiped clean, it's gone, it's forgotten. Now, quite how an all-powerful, all-knowing God can forget things, it will have to remain one of those kind of mysteries or paradoxes of the Godhead. But if you don't believe me, let's just look at some of the people mentioned in this short passage. God said to Moses, I'm the God of your father, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Amongst their other failings, Abraham passed his wife off as his sister to the king of Egypt, which resulted in a plague on the Egyptians. He failed to fully trust God's promise about his own future. He gave in to his wife's demands to have a son with his concubine, And then he cast the poor woman and her son out into the desert when the promised son Isaac was born, all of which is pretty shoddy behavior. Isaac favored Esau over Jacob to such a degree that it's still partly responsible for some of the trouble in the Middle East up to the present day, although Abraham also contributed to that. And Jacob tricked Esau out of his birthright, fell out of with most of his other relatives, as well as carrying on the family tradition of favouring one or two sons over all the rest of the family. And then we get to Moses, who grew up in luxury and advantage, then committed murder, had to flee and become a refugee in a foreign land. And if you read on in Exodus, you'll find out that he messed up in a big way several other times as well, before he finally led the Israelites out of Egypt. So the point is this: that didn't stop God using any of those less than ideal people to achieve his purposes. And generally, their lives went much better when they let God's purposes succeed in their lives, whatever their past failures have been. And it's the same for us too. Whatever our failures, real or perceived, it can all be forgiven and forgotten. And God will use us if we let him. What does a God of the future mean for us practically? Well, I guess the obvious one is the dead are not dead. And to prove this, we need to read some other verses. And this has come very nicely from the lectionary reading, so thank you for that, Simon. A couple of verses from Mark's Gospel, which is quite nicely picked out and fit in very well. This is Jesus replying to the Sadducees when they were arguing with him in Mark's Gospel about whether there was life after death, because they didn't believe that. And Jesus' reply is, "Now about the dead rising, have you not read in the book of Moses," he means Exodus in this case, "in the account of the burning bush, how God said to Moses, 'I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob.' He is not the God of the dead, but of the living." So Jesus, and all the Jews around him, other than the Sadducees, understood that those who have died in faith will live again. But not only that, God is not only the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's also the God of Moses, and Joshua, and Deborah, and Eli, and Samuel, Saul, David, Solomon, Elijah and Elisha, Isaiah, Hezekiah, Josiah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Esther, Ezra, Nehemiah, you get the idea, on into the New Testament, and on through the last 2,000 years of Christian history, practice and belief. And what that means for us is that what God has done in the lives of these great biblical heroes and heroines, both in the Old Testament, the New Testament, and since that time, the miracles that they have seen, the prayers that God has answered for them, the changes that God has brought about in their lives and in the communities that they've lived in and touched, all of that is possible for us as well. That is the proof of the living God, the great I Am God, who acts in the lives of those who trust him and believe in him. So I hope that is an encouragement for you. It's not just jam tomorrow, so to speak. You can do that all in our lives today. And that's really the promise for us. And how's that going to happen? Well, it's going to happen because we can only really meet God in the present and be aware of his presence, which is what Moses was at that particular time when he saw that burning bush. So Moses was open to God's presence. Only the burning bush caught his attention, and God called to him and he approached. And he did a simple thing just to show his obedience by taking off his sandals. And as I say, if you read on in Exodus, you realize that it was far from plain sailing, even after that event, that particular meeting with God. He was actually perceived by, well, both the communities he lived in as a traitor. He did commit murder. He was a coward. He was tongue-tied, disobedient, and rebellious. But God still used him, even after all of that. And it's worth thinking also about the preparation and the perseverance that Moses went through at that time. We learn elsewhere that Moses was 40 years an Egyptian prince, having a privileged position, an education, good health, intimate knowledge and thorough understanding of Egyptian society, palace politics, etc. Probably learned a lot about leadership. And then he was 40 years in the wilderness, tending sheep for his father-in-law, which was probably quite a substantial family business, not just a humble farm. Ideal training, perhaps, for leading a reluctant, wayward flock of unwilling, squabbling Israelite refugees in the desert for 40 years. And that was with God providing all the food and water as well. probably major organisational, logistical and leadership challenges to sort out. So there was a lot of preparation going on in Moses' life there. So whatever Moses thought about his abilities, we can see looking back that he was actually the ideal person for God to use for that. So in conclusion, for us, if we're trusting in God, our past is forgiven, forgotten as far as God's concerned. Our future is secure, not just the promise of eternal life, but the trust that actually God can do just as amazing things in our lives in terms of miracles, prayers, and perhaps most difficult of all, changes to our lives. And that can happen if we meet God in the present and if we're open to his presence amongst us. We sang earlier, actually, a verse that crops up in Hebrews, doesn't it? Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Another proof, if it were needed, that Jesus is God and that God's nature doesn't change. And our response to that, of course, should be worship, which I think is what we're going to do now. Simon.
Thanks, Jonathan. Isn't that great?